I believe that since Representative Gardner has been here the longest, I'm sure he's probably had opportunity to look at the minutes. Would you like to move adoption of the minutes, Representative Gardner?
I would, Madam Chair.
Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes from last meeting? If not, all in favor of approval of the minutes?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Okay. Today on the agenda, we have a couple of bills that have been proposed that we would like to discuss here in a group with a lot of expertise on various solid waste and recycling issues. And first up, we'll have Representative West's House File 2746. Representative West, would you like to discuss your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to discuss it. If you and members will forgive me, I think I triple dosed on NyQuil before I came in this morning, so if I say things that don't make any sense, just ask me to clarify for the record. I can go through this bill, describe some of the who it applies to, and then how it applies as well. This was a bill that was sent to me by a friend of mine in California, who, if people are familiar with California politics, they have term limits, and they all just rotate into city council, state house, and state senate seats out there. This particular individual is a friend of mine on the LA City Council, who used to be in the state senate and in the state house, the California Assembly. There was a bill that was passed in California requiring recycling, plastic bag recycling. People are familiar with the proliferation of blowing plastic bags around our cities, and the idea is to require recycling so that we see less of it, and also there's the obvious solid waste impact of it as well. This would apply to a chain of stores, which means five or more stores that are engaged in the same field of business. It would apply to a store that has over 5,000 square feet of retail, and the bags have to be over 2.25 milliliters thick. The program would essentially require, this is the fundamental, there are five primary requirements, writing on the bag that states please reuse or recycle at a participating store. It would also require a bin for the collection of the bags. Third, it would require that all the plastic in the bag be recycled in a manner consistent with the statute. Four, that the plastic that's collected is free of foreign material, as people are familiar with in recycling. Obviously, that's critical. And five, that reusable bags be made available for people who shop in the store as well. It does include retailers across the board, so it's not singling out any one industry at all. And it also has manufacturer responsibilities in Subdivision 3 that require transportation and collection. The penalty provisions include $300 per day for each day that a person is out of compliance, and an operator who violates is subject to initial penalty of $100 followed by $700 within a year, or $1,000 within a year of the initial violation. And also, and finally, the last section, members, states that you can use your own supply for 6 months after the enactment date. That's essentially the gist of it. I think it makes sense for Minnesota because we are definitely moving in the direction where people are a lot more aware of recycling, and especially those elements in our solid waste system that proliferate more or take up more space. And plastic bags are one of those items because you go to the store and three items in each bag, next thing you know, you got a dozen bags you're hauling home. I know in my kitchen I've got one drawer that I just keep stuffing all these things into, and hopefully I can reuse them once in a while, but there is no way to reuse as many as I get from other retail establishments that I shop at. I did also, I had an opportunity to speak with the grocers, who are very nice people to talk with, by the way, and they have some concerns regarding the availability of recycling facilities in greater Minnesota. I had stated that I am interested in working with them, and Madam Chair, you and I had a discussion about that, I think it was yesterday, as well. I said I think that's something that could be talked about in the context of the bill. Also, the other concern was the reporting requirements. I tend to think reporting requirements are important so that we can gauge how effective we are in the application of the law. But I said that we could obviously talk about the details of that as well. So that's what I would say in terms of walking through the bill, Madam Chair and members, and I'd certainly stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Blatt. Does anyone have any questions at this point? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative Blatt. Did the grocers talk at all about some of the existing recycling infrastructure for plastic bags?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, they did. They stated that in the areas where recycling facilities are available, they're already doing what the bill requires. And I wanted to be specific about that too, because I know a lot of times we'll have industries come in and say, you know, we're already taking care of this, can you lay off? And I said I wanted to know, no, are you really doing the letter of the law with respect to, you know, what this would require? And they said, well, yeah, I mean, we are. We've got these programs in place. It's voluntary, of course. You don't have to do it. But for the most part, their members are doing that, which I think is really good. It's a good start. Of course, you know, where the burden is seen as slightly onerous whatsoever, a retailer is not going to do it. And I think we need to rectify that, and maybe through policy and act methods by which it can be universal.
Madam Chair, this is a
Representative Gardner.
Follow-up, and I'd be happy to jot out some suggestions, too, because I know when the there was one reverse a vendor who had been collecting this stuff about 6 or 7 years ago, and then their baler broke, and they just decided to get out of the bag business altogether. And then it just, they stopped collecting bags everywhere in Duluth, St. Cloud, and the Twin Cities, and the recycling people I know got more angry calls about not being able to get their plastic bags recycled than any other complaint they'd ever received. So Some people did put together that voluntary program, and some of my neighbors who are in a group house actually go to a nonprofit in Baton Rouge Heights, and they actually collect that ag from grocery stores, and my brother-in-law manages a store, and he says it's actually worked out quite well. And I think there are some retailers that I've chosen for whatever reason, you know, feng shui or ambiance or whatever, they just don't want to have the collection bags in their lobbies, but they pay into the system. But that is also voluntary. So, you know, my suggestion might be, you know, everybody who has the bags ought to participate in some fashion to support the overall effort. And I guess I had questions, too, about Greater Minnesota. I know that counties had expressed to me when I was in recycling that people wanted to recycle their plastic bags. And it's a question of how you backhaul with your distributors and things like that. And I don't know how we solve that, but I commend you for moving it along. I think that's something that consumers have been craving, and knowing what happens to the bags too is always of interest. When they restarted the program, there were some retailers that were just chucking them because the staff hadn't been briefed. But in fact, they go to make plastic lumber, which is in really high demand, and which we make in Minnesota too. So I guess that would be my one suggestion, is that if we could make sure some retailer doesn't want to actually collect the material that they pay into the system or however it's set up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. By way of additional comment to Representative Gardner's comments, I was struck by when the grocers came in and said, you know, the difference between us and California is California really does have these facilities all around the state to do that. Sort of thinking to myself, why is Minnesota not? That California would have availability, even in the sparsest population density counties, have readily available recycling facilities, and yet in Minnesota we don't. And I think at some point, the band-aid needs to be ripped off, and we need to move in a position where around the state we do have those facilities. Because until we get to that point, we're just going to be doing business the same old way. And I don't think it will facilitate our ability to move in that direction. Perhaps once the commerce value of recycling is realized throughout the state, that actually it will support recycling facilities like this throughout Greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative West. Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative West, I think this is a good issue for us to keep wrestling with and see where we can move forward. I would just say that I'd encourage you to creatively think about how we might actually deal with other large volume distributors of plastic bags. I know our daily paper gets delivered in one that sometimes has lots of advertising printed on the plastic bag, but most of the time it's a generic yellow or clear one, and it would be nice if they would promote and support recycling as well, because it's really contributing a high volume. I know it makes it easier for the carrier, but it doesn't necessarily need to be something that people don't know what to do with after they've gotten it.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, and I actually don't see if there's anything wrong with reading a wet newspaper. I think it builds character.
She's gonna whack your dangerous dog with it.
That's right.
Yeah.
I would just be curious right now if there is anyone here from the grocery, representing the grocery industry, that might like to make a few comments. And then after that, I would also like to hear from, if there's anybody here from either Recycling Association of Minnesota or the PCA that could make some comments on market development and the availability of facilities. So first, if there's someone from the grocery, thank you. And if you would state your name, please, for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the working group. I'm Jamie Poole, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. Just a little background, the MGA is a trade association representing nearly 1,200 food retailers, distributors, and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 60,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. When dealing with environmental legislation, I think it's important to ask, what is our desired result, and how do we get there together? Mandating what is already being done effectively where the state infrastructure allows is not the best way to reduce waste. The daily business of grocers and the rest of the retail community is dedicated by consumer wants, needs, and demands. Therefore, grocers and retailers have responded by offering voluntary plastic bag recycling. It's an innovative It's in the Bag program, was created in October of 2003 by local companies in partnership with the Chamber and WasteWise to deal with this very issue. The program collects plastics, which is grocery bags, retail bags, dry cleaning bags, newspaper bags. We take it all in at local grocery stores and retail outlets. Collecting is done by Merrick. It's a nonprofit organization employing disabled Minnesotans. Last year, this program alone was responsible for collecting 1.1 million pounds of plastics and that were recycled and made into decking. So it is a program that is working. This is voluntarily funded by the stores that participate. There's a membership to be paid, and additionally, each time the bags are picked up, the retailers are supporting that, and so it is something we are doing. It's unique to the state of Minnesota and is just beginning to be done throughout other areas in the country. So my question is, why mandate what is voluntarily being done successfully? This program is not the only one in the state. We have a distributor that is based here that is now engaged in picking these plastics back up and getting them recycled throughout the state. One grocer in Sandstone in particular can't get support from his community, so he's driving these back to the Venice Heights Merrick plant once a month to make sure that he can offer this to his consumers. One of our specific concerns is the lack of rural support for programs like these. Many communities do not have the facilities or offer to support this mandate. A statement that I really would like to think is important is the key to encouraging recycling is educating consumers. When these bags are floating around and we see things, it's the consumers that need to have the easy option to recycle them. Merrick is running at full capacity to what our understanding is, so they could use additional outlets. Many communities don't offer curbside pickup for these plastics, so I think finding a way to correct these would create more green collar jobs and result in more recycled plastics, which is where I think we want to get to. The Minnesota Grocers Association believes educating consumers is a crucial step. In that vein, we have applied for a grant through Pollution Control to start a public awareness campaign to educate consumers about recycling plastics and the value in reusable grocery bags. Mandating, adding penalties, and requiring record keeping for outcomes that are already measurable simply seems to go against the ecological principles in reducing the carbon impact. Another notable concern is that our business is driven by consumers. We have reusables, paper, and plastic available when you check out to encourage consumers to make prudent choices. Consumers make these choices every day, and our energies would be best served in educating consumers and making easy, reusable choices for them, curbside pickup to improve the solid waste stream. Grocers and our friends in the retail business are looking for ways to educate consumers. At the end of the day, sustainability is a shared responsibility between business, government, and consumers. In closing, we don't believe the mandate is necessary. We believe that all merchants who offer plastic bags can work together to find a workable and easy solution. The entire retail community cares deeply about its consumers, its environment, and we do want to leave Minnesota a little cleaner than we found it. Thank you for the opportunity to give my comments, and I do stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Poole. Mm-hmm. Representative Hortman.
Thank you. I was wondering, do you know what percent of stores in Minnesota are participating in the voluntary program?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I certainly can get that back to you.
Do you know what percentage of the plastic bags that are used in the grocery industry are recycled in Minnesota?
I don't know that because we are taking in all the plastics, so we don't. It is not inputs in, inputs out, because we're picking up the newspaper sleeves and the dry cleaning bags. Even record keeping is not going to give you an accurate picture of what's being taken out is what's coming in. We're also recycling for some of our other retail partners that may not offer this, so it isn't grocery versus
input. Thank you. Just a follow-up, Madam Chair.
I'm sure
a waste composition study of some kind to give you an idea what percent that you're getting back are grocery as opposed to others, so that would be really good information to have. But my sense is that the mandate that Representative West is proposing, he's proposing because voluntary programs are nice, but a little bit here and a little bit there is not a comprehensive solution. And there are many other industries where recycling of products is mandated. My family sells used auto parts. We're recycled, mandated to recycle oil, batteries, antifreeze. So I think as we kind of expand our view of what we need to be responsible for in our environment, it's only natural that this will extend to other sectors of the retail economy.
Thank you. I have a question for you as well. I'm just wondering if you have somebody from Merrick here, but probably I would think, you know, with regard to that question of what the percentage of bags are actually recyclable, I would assume that they would have figures already for how much they throw away versus how much they send off to recycling, so that they would probably be able to give you an answer currently just based on, you know, what their stream is going out. And I would also like to know a little bit more. You mentioned that you have a grant from the PCA to work on this project. Did you just apply for it or did you receive it? I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Madam Chair, we've just applied for it. We won't find out until May if we've actually received to run the campaign.
Thank you. And would that be a statewide campaign?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, yes.
When we're talking about statewide within your association, are all members of all grocery stores members of your association, or is your effort only going to go to certain members? You know, what I'm getting at is how many groceries are going to actually participate in this? Is it just some large chains, or is it everybody?
Madam Chair, our membership is large chains throughout the state and independents from each end of the border, and this would be something because it is through the Pollution Control Agency that we would go broad spectrum and not just it wouldn't be just to our membership. We would offer the opportunity to educate consumers all across the board. So if someone wasn't a member, they would still have the opportunity to participate in the program.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
At this time, is there any comment on the market development with regard to this? And please state your name for the record. Thank you.
My name is Wayne Jervey. I'm Recycling Market Development Coordinator for the Pollution Control Agency, and I work on a variety of market development issues, in particular film. Markets, I can talk a little bit about the markets and where the material goes. Generally, when you're looking at markets for materials, you're talking about collecting truckload quantities, which is important for the end markets. Trex, which is located in Virginia, and AERT, Choice Decking, which is located in Arkansas and Texas, are the main buyers of this film right now. Markets are between 16 and 25 cents a pound, so there's a pretty good price if you can get it in a truckload quantity. In Minnesota, our plastic lumber manufacturers use milk containers or natural. We do have some projects coming online with film that will be able to process film in Minnesota, but that is still 6 to 12 months away in terms of that. Madam Chair, is there any additional things that you'd like to know about the market?
Thank you. At this point, no, unless there are other questions. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morning, Mr. Jervey. How are you?
Good morning. Hi.
You and your office have been very successful in getting people together to do things, and I know that your office had a financial role also in the It's in the Bag program that works for the grocers as well as the private sector. But just getting the end markets, the industries that actually haul the stuff, the people who collect it, you know, just getting them together and pulling them together to get them to say, we could do this all for mutual benefit. And it seemed to me that we could use a little extra push for spreading outside the metro area in this, and at least getting to the major metropolitan areas outside the Twin Cities. Do you know what it would take to do that? Just to maybe get some of the grocers to say, all right, we can get economies of scale by concentrating bags at this county facility here, and then backhaul them this way. Is that kind of thinking progressing?
Yeah, generally, the issue with is centralization and having the ability to process the material. So, in Merrick's case, we gave them a grant for two downstroke balers, which is a vertical, which allowed them to start up their program. Generally, in a lot of the cases, particularly in the retail establishments, they will have a baler or for cardboard, but not have additional baler to dedicate to a film. In terms of rural Minnesota, the central hub type of thing, either at a county or a distribution center, would be the thing that you would have to do to, again, get those truckload quantities. And also work with the opportunities for backhauling of goods out there. So getting those transportation logistics figured out, if there's an empty truck coming back to the Twin Cities or to the market, working to piggyback on some of those things.
Are you guys doing anything to help coax grocers or other distributors to move in that direction?
At the point where retail film, we haven't devoted a whole lot of time to that. Our focus right now on film is, in particular, the ag plastic silage bags.
Are there any further questions? No, thank you, Mr. Jordan. I appreciate your comments. Is there anyone else that would like to make any comments on this particular bill? Well, I would just like to comment that since we're not you know, officially a committee that will be moving the bill forward. We just are listening at this point in time, trying to vet some of these in the first place and give people within the industry that have an interest an opportunity to talk about some of these bills before they move on to, in this case, the Environment Committee. So I appreciate very much the opportunity at this time to hear from a number of you, and I would presume that Representative West will be working with some of you additionally in the future as this bill progresses. All right. Next, I would like to hear from Representative Portman. I believe you have two bills, and we can talk first about the fluorescent lamp.
Should I go over here?
Yes, please.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. What I have today for you is a draft of a fluorescent light bulb recycling bill that uses the successful e-waste model as a way to deal with fluorescent light bulb recycling in Minnesota. And fluorescent light bulbs are similar in some regards to the electronic waste problem. People don't know what to do with them. They're not entirely aware of the toxic substances that are in them. And there's no really easy method for consumers right now to recycle bulbs. Very few retailers take them back. And those that do and are starting to think about taking them back have an issue about training staff to know that they have mercury in them, and if they break, they've got OSHA issues with cleaning up and the amount of mercury that's permissible in the workplace. So retail take-back would be complicated, I think, in this area because of the breakable nature of fluorescent light bulbs. Similar also to e-waste, there is a recycling infrastructure in place. There's Green Lights Recycling in Blaine, there's Mercury Waste Solutions, and there's another one in Minnesota. There are companies that are already doing this. The problem is the household consumer doesn't usually know that this is available. And counties do accept in the metro area at their household hazardous waste sites fluorescent light bulbs for recycling for a charge, similar to what they were doing for computers, used computers. But the average consumer in Minnesota is not usually going to their household hazardous waste facilities and knowing that that's their opportunity and knowing that they should do that. So building on what was very successful with the e-waste model, where by having manufacturers have to certify that they're recycling a certain percentage of the pounds sold in Minnesota, and creating a penalty per pound if they don't creates a credit scheme, much like we're talking about carbon cap and trade and auction, where a credit for fluorescent light bulb recycling comes into the marketplace. So what that does is creates incentives like it has in the e-waste field for retailers or recyclers or counties to have big collection events. And the benefit of a collection event over a retail take-back situation is you have trained staff who have the right receptacles to put the light bulbs in and who can handle them appropriately. So I thought that as we really have been looking with a number of people and talking to a number of people about what we could do to make fluorescent light bulb recycling easier, and when I saw how well the e-waste model was working, it seemed that this is something we should talk about with regard to this area also.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Are there any questions?
I would ask Mr. Eliff to invite if there's anything about the way the bill is structured that's different from the e-waste model or that I didn't really mention but he thinks is worth mentioning.
Let me go through and take a look because there are some differences. I know one thing that's different is, I think under the e-waste bill, we require collectors to register with the PCA, and I don't think we do that for this program for the fluorescent bulbs. Also, we we did have mechanism in the e-waste program where if companies collected above their quota, they would get credits that could be used in following years or traded to companies that did not achieve their quota. That's currently not in this bill, but could easily be put into it. And I think another thing is in the e-waste bill, we gave additional weighting to products that were collected outside the metropolitan areas. That was not done for fluorescent lighting. Another difference was requiring the sales figures to be reported to the Department of Revenue under the e-waste bill. Here we allow those figures to be reported to PCA, but we included provisions that will keep that material non-public to prevent the disclosure of the identity of any manufacturer participating in the collection and recycling. There were some other differences too. I think there was a concern that e-waste not be ultimately recycled in countries that didn't have the kind of environmental controls that we wanted, especially given some of the hazardous substances that we were talking about. We didn't think that was necessary for this bill. And I think we also had a program under e-waste that gave additional, allowed the commissioner of PCA to use some of the registration fees for grants, I believe, to outstate counties to help them in their recycling efforts. And I believe that is not in this bill as well. Those are the ones I can think of right now.
Thank you, Mr. Eva. Representative Hortman? Yep.
That's all I have. I'd be interested to get more feedback from the people who are here, and if there's anybody here from the PCA that can speak to how they calculate what we're recycling now and what the limits of our calculation process is. When I first started looking into this issue, we had received information from the PCA that ranked mercury emissions in Minnesota, and of course number one was power plant emissions. But not very far down the list was mercury from crematoria. That's fillings in people's teeth that get incinerated when they're cremated, and fluorescent lamp breakage. And then I looked a little into the details of how we estimate the mercury pollution from fluorescent lamp breakage, and I thought it's probably understated the size of the problem. So, all right.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Yes, we do have someone from the PCA that could address this. And I think we also have some other testifiers as well from the industry. And I don't know if there is someone here from the counties as well that maybe would have some comments. But at any rate, please state your name for the record.
My name is Garth Heckel. I'm with the Product Stewardship Team at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today, and I'll try to do my best to answer questions. Our mercury-containing product specialist is actually John Gilkison, so I'll be filling in for him today. Regarding the issue around recycling of fluorescents and trying to get a handle on that specific recycling rate, that is a challenge. Much like the e-waste issue, is that we don't have we do now, obviously, excuse me, following the enactment of the Minnesota Electronics Recycling Law, but we don't have a good sense of sales into the state to be able to calculate that generation baseline. And then we also, at this point, have data coming back from the Household Hazardous Waste Programs regarding what they're collecting, but we do not have specific reports from retailers and others that may be providing that collection service. And so trying to be able to come up with a definitive recycling rate is a bit of a challenge. I can try to give you some specific data points that at least provide some context on the issue. As you're all aware, fluorescents, and particularly CFLs, like electronic products, do tend to last a long time, which certainly complicates that recycling rate calculation. It's very different than some other products, newspapers, and so forth that are collected through the Blue Box program. So I just want to make you aware of that. The agency does estimate that in terms of just compact fluorescents, there were about 3.5 million CFLs that were sold in Minnesota in 2007. That is taking national sales data and prorating it for Minnesota. On the management side, as was referenced, the household hazardous waste facilities are the primary venue for collecting fluorescents. However, those collection opportunities are not consistent throughout the state. So, for instance, Dakota County and Hennepin County in the metropolitan area have very aggressive fluorescent collection program. So in 2006, Hennepin estimates that they collected about 82,000 fluorescents, with about 8,000 of those being CFLs. So about 10% of the total that were coming in, all the fluorescents were compact fluorescents. But then on the other side of the metropolitan area, Anoka County does not collect any fluorescent tubes through their collection program, and so that has been a local program decision regarding whether they will collect fluorescents or not. As was referenced, we do have an increasing interest from retailers that are interested in collecting tubes as well as CFLs, I believe in the metropolitan area. According to the Green Guardian website operated by the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, there are about 20 retailers listed that are accepting those products. Generally, there is a charge the retailers to accept those from consumers, and then the EPA estimates that those costs to manage are anywhere from 50 cents to $2 per unit.
Thank you. Are you finished with this? Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Hortman.
I wasn't sure if I heard you right. We have good information on household hazardous waste, or we don't have very good information what's being collected in household hazardous waste?
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, we do have good information from the HHW programs that are collecting fluorescents. But as I mentioned, not all of the programs do collect fluorescents, and we are in the process right now of compiling that information from 2007.
Thank you. I would just like to add as well that I'm aware of the fact that many of the counties, at least in rural areas, do not necessarily go through their household hazardous waste programs, but rather collect them just on their own, as Mr. Hickel mentioned, with local leeway within the counties. So some counties have programs currently where dropping off compact fluorescent light bulbs, and fluorescent light bulbs are free to residents and to businesses within the county. I do not know the extent of that throughout the state, and I don't know if you have that figure, if Mr. Gilkison has that figure, if it comes in on the reports from the counties, but I do know that a number of counties are currently doing that right now, and also there are a number of hardware store chains that will also currently accept fluorescent light bulbs. However, there does not seem to be a very conclusive way of doing things throughout the whole state. But I would like to, that was one of the things I was wondering if someone from the counties, from the SWA, Solid Waste Administrators Group, that might be able to give us information on what each county is currently doing. It would be helpful, I think, to get that information quantified from the counties. I think also that the situation with recycling of fluorescent bulbs is at a somewhat different level than e-waste, meaning it's a little bit more advanced, we have a little bit more infrastructure in place. But clearly it's not universal, and that seems to be even more clear that there's a lot of questions out in the public about what do you do with it. Maybe the counties actually have a program, but nobody knows about it. So there seems to definitely be room for improvement within the recycling of fluorescent bulbs. So at this time, there are no further questions. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Loffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Hickel, to this point, does the PTA typically undertake surveys on a regular basis to kind of get baseline data, or is this something that kind of nobody really has stepped up to take responsibility in terms of gathering the data on an ongoing basis to know what's happening where?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we do get reports from the Household Hazardous Waste Programs, and there's 58 of those across the state. And we can certainly provide data in terms of what their fluorescent collection numbers are. We'd be happy to provide that. The problem becomes is trying to then place that data in the context of a recycling rate, because we have not had a process whereby manufacturers, retailers, and others along the sales chain are actually providing that sales data to the agency for us to be able to make that kind of recycling rate calculation. But we can certainly provide data about what is coming in through the household hazardous waste facilities. And I also should mention that as a result of Representative Portman's mercury bill last year, there is a reporting requirement that the mercury recyclers will be required to submit to the agency starting March 1st. So that's right around the corner, and that will provide another data point for us to be able to track what's being collected.
Just a follow-up to that, do those 58 household hazardous waste programs cover the entire state, so some are multi-county, or are there still gaps even in the coverage of that program?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, there is an obligation for there to be household hazardous waste collection opportunities in each county, but you are correct. Several of the programs do operate on a multi-county basis.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know there are other people here that who may want to comment on the bill, but one of the things I forgot to mention is I think the least known fact about the federal energy bill that was signed into law in December is that it requires a phase-out of incandescents by 2013. So to my way of thinking, we don't have a lot of time to figure out how we're going to solve this problem, because the market will be changing quite a bit very rapidly.
Mr. Hickel, did you have a comment on that? Representative Portman, your remarks are very well taken, and certainly something that we ought to be, you know, taking into account, because as with e-waste and any other segment of the waste stream, when there is some change either federally or just in the use federal law or in the use of materials, we end up needing to anticipate that change and have an infrastructure in place to deal with that through our solid waste infrastructure. So, if there are no further questions for Mr. Hickel, thank you.
Thank you.
And I think there's Brad Busher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for Waste Management, and I'm here on behalf of Waste Management Lamp Tracker, a recycler located in Roseville, Minnesota. And with me is Mark Stennis. He's the General Manager at Lamp Tracker, at Waste Management Lamp Tracker. And this is really a two-part presentation. The first part is by Waste Management Lamp Tracker, and then Brad Busher from Mercury Waste Solutions, and Peter Larson will present on behalf of Mercury Waste Solutions. Just a little bit of background on the company. Brad Busher from Mercury Waste Solutions started up this company about 11 and a half years ago, and about a year ago, Waste Management purchased the container, the outside container, and the recycling facility. There is a patent pending on the liner that's part of the container that transports the lamps, and Brad Buescher has maintained ownership of that. So this is a two-part presentation focusing on the recycling infrastructure that is already has been developed, but also on the need for this container from an environmental standpoint and an exposure standpoint. So I just wanted to share with you some of the work that we've been doing. We've been working with retailers in the past several years to try to get the recycling infrastructure available for the consumers. So consumers are purchasing CFLs at major retailers, and we want to be able to provide them with a container so that once the spent bulb needs to be managed to be recycled, the consumer then has a box that they can safely transport the spent bulb in. We're investigating a lot of opportunities. We're working with the utilities. We're trying to figure out how we can connect with their conservation programs. There's a lot of activity that's currently going on. Utilities through their conservation programs are working with some of the retailers. And we've begun discussions with how we can work with those utilities to try to, again, make sure that these lamps are put in the proper container, that they're containerized so that they don't break, and so that when consumers are transporting them to a recycling facility or a household hazardous waste facility, the exposure then is limited. So this is really a product that's very different from a CRT, in that a CRT is, the exposure is much less, and you have a lamp that is very easily broken, and it really requires extra care and handling. And our product really ensures that that is going to happen safely, and that there is protection from exposure. There's a lot of different systems that are currently developing. We need to gather data on those systems, figure out which are the best, what is the best way to go, what's going to work, and how we can safely reduce the exposure rather than creating additional exposure. There's a lot of discussion going on. We hope that there's a way that we can figure out how to foster additional discussion and facilitate that, and look at goals as a starting point, recycling goal for the state, instead of forging ahead with a system that we're not quite sure whether it will work. Again, Mark Dennis is here with me today, and he can offer any background on our facility in Roseville and how that works, and we would be more than willing to offer you a tour of that facility if you're interested.
Thank you.
Thank you.
State your name for the record, please.
Mark Dennis. I'm General Manager of Waste Management Lamp Trackers. And I've been involved in lamp recycling since 1996, when Mercury Waste Solutions was formed. It was our facility in Roseville. It was geared towards the commercial side of the business. And lamp recycling initially started out as driving around businesses picking up their lamps. And in the process of that, we developed a container system, which when Universal Waste Rule went into effect in 2000, we were able to offer a container that we would ship to the customer via UPS, and the customer could fill it up and then return it to us. So it's a nice, convenient way to essentially reach everybody in the country, and it's been effective with small business and with very large companies with nationwide facilities. And in the process of that, we continued to refine the container that we provided as we experienced, you know, the hazards the lamps would go through, until the point where we developed a container that is actually a box inside a bag, inside a box. There's a the foil bag we were talking about separates, is between the two boxes. The lamps are loaded in the inner box. The foil bag can be closed and prevents the release of mercury vapor from any broken lamps. And then the outside box is a shipping container. We send them directly to the customer. They fill them up, send them back. So we can reach every corner of the country. In addition, we provide online reporting for that customer. The customer can order online, and they can see all of their transactions they've ever had with us, every container they've ordered, every container that they have on site, and every container they've recycled by facility and by any time period they want to look at. So we provide complete reporting to them. So in effect, we can provide information on how many lamps we're getting from any state, city, zip code that our customers are in. In May of 2007, Waste Management acquired this portion of Mercury Waste Solutions. And at about the same time, we worked with Walmart, and we provided them with a kiosk. They had a recycling event last June, which they put a kiosk in each of their stores in Minnesota and four other states as a test to see what would happen for CFL recycling. It was well publicized in Minnesota, and the response was huge, but the response was in Fort Worth lamps, and we think it was largely businesses and not consumers that were bringing them in. We received a fairly small amount of CFLs in that process. But since that point in time, we've been continuing to work to try to find a solution for CFLs, as we saw the rate of CFL sales just skyrocket here in the last year, in large part because of Walmart's promotion, which followed up on Energy Star's promotion of the program. And then other retailers like Home Depot, you know, became involved as well. So we started to work on a solution to provide that, a recycling opportunity. We've spent a considerable amount of time talking to retailers, talking to utilities, talking to manufacturers about how best to do this. And we're continuing to learn as we go here. I'm attending the Energy Star National Conference on this topic next week in Phoenix, and we'll be meeting with a number of additional utilities and retailers and manufacturers at that time. And you know, there is an interest in providing a program. It's just a question of what's the best way to do it. Retailers are very concerned with breakage in the store, how to safely get it in the store if it's coming in the store. They have problems with lamps being sold, let alone, you know, being brought back. It's very concerned about that. Utilities have been very active in promoting the energy efficient lighting, and they recognize that they need to participate in closing the loop as well. So I think there's very active interest in this whole idea. It's just a question of the best way to do it. And I guess our feelings are, at this point, we're going down a number of tracks, including the kiosk idea, but also developing a home product that could be utilized and shipped back to us. We found, certainly in recycling other types of items, the recycling rate is closely related to the convenience to the consumer, to the point where, at my house anyway, we have a single storage container. You just dump everything in and it goes away, and certainly increase the recycling rate. And I think the same thing is going to happen on this type of thing, as opposed to electronics, where people recognize they shouldn't throw them in the trash, and they're kind of big anyway to hide in the trash, if that's what they're trying to do. And so, for instance, when the IKEA, there was a recycling event at Mall of America, and the response was huge, but I think that was just a pent-up demand from people with closets full of stuff they didn't know what to do with. CFLs are much smaller, very easily breakable, and you know, we think we need to provide a way for them to be contained in the home and then easily, conveniently, transported out. The problem with that scenario is cost involved, and that's what we're really trying to work with these other parties involved to see what we can do about offering other ways to do it that lowers the cost or distributes the cost in some other way. So our feeling at this point is we're certainly not opposed to this bill. Thinks that CFL recycling is a great idea, but that the market is not quite developed to the point where we know what the best solutions are. We'd like to continue to explore that and investigate and begin to offer some solutions and see how they're responded to and see what we find is successful, see what partners we can pick up to participate in the program. And we think that is in motion and will happen. We're also interested in the portion of the bill and the extent that these light bulbs last a long time. And if we use a 5-year average, the bulbs being sold now, we're out to 2012 or 2013, potentially before we see a significant volume. It seems like the recycling rate would have to be tied to the sales of several years ago to be even potentially come close to being reached.
Additional comments? Representative Portman.
Thank you. I was wondering, do you know in 1996, is that around the time that the commercial requirements for recycling came into play?
I think that was about 1993.
Okay.
Mercury Waste acquired a company that was already in place there. And I think that's about when it started.
And then there just occurs to me that when we talk about green collar jobs and the things that we're doing here, although sometimes the mandate for recycling sounds uncomfortable to the business community, it sounds like the mandate for commercial recycling kind of got some industries going. And so the key for us to focus on is how to do this in a way that's good for business and does grow jobs and, not to leave too soon.
I did have one additional question. I was trying to get my mind around how these boxes work with 8-footers. Presumably this is for 4-foot and CFLs and smaller?
We do 8-foot. The biggest volume in commercial side by far is 4-foot land. We provide various containers for 8-foot, 6-foot, 4-foot U-bent. Mm-hmm. Those are shaped curves in the U. We have boxes for compact for commercial use or odd assorted lamps. We have boxes for HIDs, street lights, and those types of containers. So we try to cover the full gamut of containers.
I'm just curious, are you getting much use out of these with the larger, the 8-foot, the 6-footers? It seems like a cumbersome
situation. It is cumbersome. I'm not sure the UPS drivers appreciate it, but...
That's
definitely a challenge.
I wasn't sure it even met their guidelines for.
Yes, our packages are designed to meet UPS guidelines.
Okay.
Other people offer this type of program. We're the only ones on UPS because of the strictness of their guidelines and the way we do contain lamps.
Well, thank you very much. If there are no further questions, I think there was one other gentleman that wanted to speak. Yes?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Brad Busher. I'm the CEO of the four-name company, Mercury Waste Solutions, and another successor company called Vaporlock Products. To my right is my general counsel and the charge of our government affairs, both here and at federal level in Washington, Peter Larson. Many of you may know is also the former commissioner of the MPCA here in Minnesota some years ago under Carlson's administration. As a matter of background, I wanted to comment that I appreciate an opportunity to appear yet again here in Minnesota on this very important matter. Representative Hortman has had an opportunity to introduce a bill which was successfully passed last year that we commented on. And I thought I'd start by giving you a little bit broader perspective on what's going on at the federal level and also on a state-by-state approach. In my capacity as the founder of the aforementioned company, I was also very active in our trade association. I'm the former chairman of the Association of Lighting and Mercury Recyclers. Today I run the largest mercury reclamation facility on the planet that's based in Wisconsin. And we're proud to have our partnership with the people at Waste Management who are very actively engaged in trying to segregate these mercury streams from their landfills. In that capacity, I also operated as the chairman of our basically legislative committee, and so I've been extremely active on, if you will, on a state-by-state basis as to what's going on around the United States and also at the federal level. Melissa was correct. In 1992, we passed a law here in Minnesota that first started the whole notion of segregating lamps out of waste streams. We, in effect, banned them from landfills. Last year, we were successful in basically making it a law now to put them in a landfill. And our friends that used to sit on the other side of the table are now sitting along side by side with us. Basically, the whole solid waste industry has woken up to the fact that at the end of the life, these lamps, if you will, have got to go somewhere, and every single one of them contain mercury. And just to give you an order of magnitude of how many of these there are out there, it's estimated there's over 5 billion of these in service right now. There's over a billion of them sold every single year in the United States alone, just in the lower 48. And that's just the statistics that we can get from the major manufacturers, because there's a fair number of these are being imported now from China, Indonesia, and India that we don't have any statistics for. The real dilemma we've had over these many years is how do we increase the recycling rates? Everybody got on board with the fact that it's great, they lower energy, you know, they're a wonderful contribution to our so-called green footprint, but at the end of their life, they all have mercury, and even small trace amounts of mercury is harmful, potentially harmful for the health and well-being of human beings, and let alone our groundwater supply. So, you know, what are we really doing here? Are we trying to save energy, but then at the end of the, you know, at some later date, creating a potential groundwater issue with the trace amounts of mercury that will no doubt leach from these things? There's been study after study after study that have indeed supported the notion that you cannot properly contain this stuff in the ground, no matter what you do, whether you encase it in concrete, you wrap it in a plastic bag, you do whatever you're going to do. And indeed, Peter and I have been going around the country going, you know, we got to concentrate on this. One of the more interesting things that just recently happened here in Minnesota is the Department of Health over at the University of Minnesota conducted about an 18-month study. And they were looking very carefully at this, if you will, this recycling container product and how these lamps are moved around. So the other piece of the notion is we should recycle them, but how do we protect the public from the incidental exposure to even relatively small trace amounts? And that study is very interesting, and I don't have it with me today, but it's publicly available, and I could get it for you, Madam Chairwoman and Ms. Hortman, at an early date. And the doctor that did it, Dr. Lisa Purcell, is going around the country now presenting this paper. The other problem we've got is that it really cuts to the heart of what you asked Mr. Hickel here a few minutes ago from the NPGA. You got to give them the tools in order to get to give you the proper kind of data. We do not have any tracking mechanism. Despite what we did last year with the bill that Representative Hortman put forth and you all passed, it still doesn't require tracking from, you know, what we would say is the point of embarkation all the way to the final destination. These are not rocket science kind of features. This could be done very easily. And not only from the user standpoint, but also from the manufacturer. It wouldn't be very hard for them to provide data as to how many lamps they're selling to the retailers. It wouldn't be a huge leap for the retailers to be able to report back how many lamps they're selling. And then from the recyclers and also the producers, or the what we call the generators, those that are using them, to provide that information on an integrated basis. In effect, that is what that product that we sold to Waste Management does. It is an integrated piece of software that allows all this information. The piece that it doesn't have is what's going on at the retail level. We have no idea what their incoming flows do. But with that piece combined with this, it would be very easy to give you recycling rates. Now, what we'd say is that, you know, you can't manage a darn thing if you can't measure it. You know, that was one of Jack Welch's axioms when he was running GE and he put a Six Sigma thing together. And it's really quite simple. You know, if we have a tracking mechanism that's required, you're going to get the recycling rates way up. which, by the way, are somewhere in the 20% range nationally, and we really don't have a clue of even what they are here in Minnesota. And, you know, we spent a fair amount of time talking to our friends over at the MPC about how we could get that done. And I think they'd tell you honestly, we need a tool. We need a tool. We need a tracking mechanism, a requirement that allows this stuff to actually flow through the whole cycle so that you can make public policy decisions about what is the best way to do it. Now, as to the piece of legislation that you're all considering, this is a piece that we frankly, very frankly, think is well ahead of its time. The infrastructure is all established. There is virtually no place in the United States that doesn't have some kind of recycling coverage today, either through private enterprise. Well, and look who brought in one of our...
Yeah,
that's great. That was wonderful. There is a perfect example of how that works. Now, this particular prop, which is now branded with Waste Management's name on it, was really designed and invented to be a safe and effective way to not just transport it. Oh, yes, thank you, Madam Hortman. That was wonderful. Pictures are worth a thousand words. But it was really designed and invented to be a safe receptacle during the period of time of accumulation. If we walked in this very building, somewhere down probably in the bowels of the infrastructure, we would no doubt find some spent lamps that are sitting around in the corner somewhere. And invariably, they're also often put in the furnace room, which is like the worst place in the world that you can store this stuff. And these things are fragile. Matter of fact, I'd hate to tell you when those come back into one of our plants what the breakage rate is, but it's large. And so our notion was that really at the end of the day, what we should be doing is trying to figure out a way to protect the public from incidental exposure from even trace amounts. And this new Minnesota Department of Health study goes even further than what our original conclusion was, that even as much as one lamp breaking in a room half this size, if it's left sitting alone for 8 hours, there's enough mercury that's going to volatilize that it potentially could peg what they call the OSHA occupancy, the PEL. So it, you know, there's a number of different factors involved. Number one, it's about protecting the public. Number two, it's about protecting people from incidental exposure. And then how do you get them to a safe place of embarkation or final destination? Well, it seems to us that the path that Waste is now on, and I got to tell you, these guys get it. You know, they understand that at the end of life, these are all going to their landfills. They got roughly an 80% market share, and that they want to be part of the solution now instead of part of the problem, because they don't want these things, you know, getting all by the weight out of their landfills here in about 30 or 40 years' time. Let's get on board and try to figure out a proactive way to do it now. They got 2,000 salespeople that are dedicated to meeting the needs of their commercial and industrial clients, and every single one of them is going to be talking about offering that as a solution. What they'd really like to see, however, is a public, if you will, private partnership. And the public share is merely to put the parameters in place to allow this to happen at a much greater rate than it is today. So our mission has been to go around and visit every single state legislature, which I safely say Mr. Larson here has done, to introduce this topic that we need a tracking mechanism, and we probably need some packaging standards. And at the end of the day, what we really need is a safe and effective way to do it. Now, if we require the producers to get into it, the manufacturers, I can tell you they hate that idea. They tried to do this in Massachusetts, and it was World War III, and they finally got down to the end, and they came up with a kind of management mechanism that requires reporting and whatnot. At the end of the day, they still didn't have tracking, and it's a mess. This is being, if you will, discussed in California, and it's an even bigger mess. They hate the idea of having to get back into it, and they outright threaten, we're going to raise the cost of these lamps up, and we're going to defeat the whole purpose of the energy savings. There's got to be a better way to do this. And indeed, I think our friends at Walmart also get it. It wasn't too long after I read the announcement that Andy Rubin, the head of sustainability down there, and Lee Scott were going to make compact fluorescence their key landmark piece of, if you will, focus of their whole Go Green strategy. Then we wrote them a letter and said, hey, great, we applaud you. But remember, at the end of the day, some well-meaning environmentalist is going to point out that for all those coal-fired power plants that you allegedly are taking offline or saving the need to build, every single one of these lamps has got a trace amount of mercury in it, and someone is going to point out to you, because they'll do the math and aggregate it, that you're merely substituting one form of mercury deprivation for another. Let's come up with a solution first. And they got that. They figured that out. Indeed, that program that Mark talked to you about was their first example to try to figure out how to work out some public-private, if you will, relationship. Now, where we think this is ultimately going to go is the retailers are going to partner up in some way, shape, or form. And that bag that sits over there, that's inside that, that's really the key to the whole deal. That, in concert, is not a complicated piece of technology. It's readily available. There are some patent pending, if you will, parts that work with it. But it contains not only the broken shards, but all of the vapors down to the non-detect level. So the notion is that the retailers are likely to come together with a solution where they either offer, give, sell the bags to the public at the time when you buy buy a compact, and you merely can put your spent compact fluorescent back into that and bring it into one of these receptacles at either Walmart or Home Depot or, you know, possibly IKEA. And, you know, you also have the notion of where you buy the lamp is the right place to return it. And now they don't have the fears about breakage on site training. They don't have to be concerned about are they large quantity generators and all of the other, you know, compending kind of regulatory concerns. I'd like to say that that's done. It's not, but we're moving down that path. What we really need is some kind of a mechanism on from the states to help encourage that kind of behavior. And whether it's either with you know, mandates, if it's with possible take-backs, if it's private partnerships with all these household hazardous waste collection sites, it, you know, we haven't really quite figured out the parameters. The other real holy grail that we should talk about is that what would happen if the manufacturers themselves decided to invent their packaging in such a way that it could also be used as a return recycling container. That seemed to me to be one of the best solutions all in as well, is require those guys to have packaging to contain their product, contain the vapors, and could be used just like we do right now in the printer cartridge industry. At the end of its life, it can go right back. It can be remanufactured and rebuilt. Well, in this case, if that container could end up being segregated and go back to a recycler somewhere that's located around the country, you know, that'd be it. We'd save a huge amount of cardboard. The handling issues would be covered. There's a number of different benefits that that would pick up just instantaneously. And indeed, California, Oregon, the state of Washington, New York, Florida, and Pennsylvania right now are all considering twists of this mechanism that we're here to talk about. And nobody, but nobody, is going very far with manufacturer take-back, because there's just too many forces that are lined up against it. You know, our industry is anxious to grow. We'd like to see the recycling rates get up, but we think it's got to happen in a different way. We think we've got to work a little more intuitively with the solid waste industry. We've got to work, shall I say, more hand-in-hand with the household hazardous waste. And we'd really like to work with the states to put these parameters in place. And the very heart of it is we'd like to see some tracking and some kind of containment standards that are met to allow this to happen in a more proactive fashion.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. I would also like to let you know that we have an aggressive schedule here. We have a number of other things we need to get to. So if your comments could be very brief, it would be appreciated. Thank you. If you indeed had a comment.
I just had a brief one, but I think Representative...
I would suggest that I will have Jack in soon, and I will be asking for a hearing in environment policy. I don't know if they'll have time to hear my bill before the headlines or not, but before the legislation moves forward, people will have another chance to testify.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, very briefly, I want to thank Representative Portman. It's been really a pleasure working with her on these issues the last few years, and she's made a tremendous difference for the environment in Minnesota and also lamp regulation across the country. Her efforts have been seemingly small in words, but they've made a big impact, and they've put Minnesota back in the lead on these issues. And hopefully you see that between Mark Dennis and Brad Buescher, and a certain to extent myself, we've got a lot of help for you as you figure these things out. I would have a simple suggestion that setting a recycling rate is a very good idea. Developing the information you need to measure against that recycling rate is a very good idea. Respectfully, having seen what other states have tried to do, picking a way to do that now is just really not something we'd suggest. We don't think you have the information you need to make that choice.
Thank you. If there are no further questions.
Very brief.
All right. Very briefly.
Thank you.
I apologize, Madam Chair, for not letting you know. I wasn't sure that I was going to say anything today. My name is Mike Robertson, representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I would just like to briefly comment on this issue because I think it's a very important one. And we would like to commend Representative Hortman for her leadership on this. I've had the opportunity to be a member of the Climate Change Advisory Group, which just completed its work, and I am now a member of the Mercury Stakeholder Group, developing an implementation strategy for the Mercury CMDL. And I think we're in a very, and as we've already heard, this is a very unique situation where, on the one hand, to reduce our greenhouse gases, we are promoting the use of these products. We want people to use these products. The Chamber is about to hopefully very soon embark on an aggressive program in energy efficiency promotion for businesses in the state. And the first step in that marketing campaign is going to be fluorescent lighting. And as we deliver that message around the state, we want to be delivering the message about how you manage the lighting waste once it completes its course. On the other hand, as I'm working on the Mercury Stakeholder TMDL Implementation Group, just within the last 10 days, we had a meeting where we talked about this issue. We said that we need a separate strategy, a very well thought out strategy to deal with this, because this is the only mercury emitting product within our inventory where we know that the mercury is going to be going up as we proceed over the coming years. Everything else we're looking at in our mercury inventory, we're talking about going down. This one is going up, and we want it to go up because it is a product that we want for, it has a beneficial purpose in reducing greenhouse gases. So I think this is a very unique situation. We in the general business community want to work with you and with all the stakeholders to find the right solution to this. And the suggestion that I would like to make is that you direct the PCA to facilitate a stakeholder working group process that would bring all of these folks together, those that are promoting the product, selling the products, distributing the products, providing the waste solutions at the end of life, the counties and governmental units that are going to help facilitate the collection of these materials from households along with the business organizations, to really study this and come up with the right solution, because this is going to be a long-term problem, one that we know we want to deal with. We're not going to reduce our mercury from these products unless we come up with a better product, and eventually we will, but we want to work with you on it, and we think that may be the best approach to proceed with, and we look forward to working with Representative Hortman on this.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you.
At this point in time, I would like to switch the order. I believe we'll hear Hortman's other bill at the end if we have time. We do have another group coming in at noon, and we do have a number of folks here that are prepared to deliver a report that we would very much like to hear with regard to recycling and some of the waste reduction and energy conservation measures here within the state office building. And so with no further ado, if we could have Madeline Choke from the Pollution Control Agency, maybe Colleen as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will just preface, in case there's anyone that is unaware of this, that several months ago, this committee, also in conjunction with the Rules Committee, put together a working organization to look at addressing those issues of waste reduction and recycling within these office buildings. We're really looking forward to the results. I know a lot of people have been working on this issue in the months previous to this, so we're looking forward to this report. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, thanks for having us here today. Thank you. that working?
Oh, all right. Bad slide there.
All right, well, in fact, it seems like it disconnected at that end, Kirk. We did have a chance to spend a good bit of time here in November and December working with the task force on paper reduction, with the fabulous staff people here at the House of Representatives who were incredibly helpful and generous with their time. I want to note just for the record, why is it working? I'm sorry, let's hold on a minute. I want to address just a moment about why we're looking at paper reduction for the record. Paper, office paper, is a large proportion of the waste stream. The MPCA has for several years been targeting office paper as a material for source reduction. And recently, the Climate Change Advisory Group also identified office paper as a target for greenhouse gas reductions. And so they have identified about 69,000 tons of office paper should be source reduced to meet their goals. It is a water and energy intensive industry, and also produces high toxicity in the manufacturing of paper. Of course, there are financial savings as well and increased efficiencies with reducing paper use. There's some estimates that generally using paper and purchasing paper can be between 1 and 3% of an organization's budget, and that's consistent with what we found here. The staff already has taken many active steps in the last few years to reduce paper, and for that we commend you and the staff. Particularly, there's good recycling capture here at the House of Representatives. We did note in the last report from the State Resource Recovery Office that there's still a large amount of paper per person coming out. About 41 pounds of paper per person are being recycled here. So that it's being recycled is good. That it's 41 pounds just indicates that there's a lot of paper. In our site visit, we had some primary observations that we wanted to share with you. We noted, first off, that there are a lot of desktop printers here, and that there is approximately one printer for each staff person, each FTE staff person here, which is coming from the Pollution Control Agency as a point of comparison. We have approximately one printer for every 15 staff people. Those individual desktop printers generally don't have duplexing capability, and duplexing is simply the ability to produce a double-sided print output. There are some people here who are working hard to take the paper out and put it back in and get both sides used, but that's not an easy thing to do. You have several biz hubs, I think you call them, for sort, the printer copiers, the larger printer copiers on each floor. And they are capable of duplexing, of copying double-sided and printing double-sided, but only about a third of those jobs are being duplexed. We had noted that second chance paper is typically not captured for reuse here, and that actually is a very low-tech but productive way of reducing paper use. The overall message here, of course, that you're hearing is that paper has two sides, and if it's only printed on one side and only used on one side, it's only half used. Moving on with our overall audit findings, and this was this data that was provided by the staff, for which we're grateful. 61.14 tons of letter and legal, just white paper, purchased over the 15-month session. We were interested in making sure that we included the budget, the non-budget, and the interim sessions as a whole. So most of the data we're presenting is comprehensive of that time period. You can see there is definitely paper use varying within the type of session, although the budget and non-budget sessions perhaps are not as different as we expected them to be. Your use is significantly less during an interim period, and that's not a surprise.
Overall, I just draw your attention down to the bottom there. About 10 million seats per 12-month year here, and that's about 23,000 seats per person. And that's considering both members and staff people, that number. That compares to a national average of about 10,000 and at the PCA of about 5,000. So your paper use overall was stacked from the floor to the ceiling of the rotunda 29 times. Just to put it in perspective. As a taxpayer supported organization, I think it's important to be concerned about not just the cost of purchasing paper, but the cost that's involved in using the paper. We're working with conservative and estimated numbers here. We had some of the costs, but not all of them that we would want to have. You can see the cost of your purchasing of paper is $95,000. The cost of using paper, almost $500,000. So it's at least here five times the cost of the purchase price. And you can see at the bottom that there are some qualifications about what we did include and what we didn't include in your cost of using the paper here. We didn't have costs yet for printers. What does it cost to purchase the printers and to repair them? Toner cartridges for printers, staff time, or the disposal cost. And the toner cartridges, just yesterday I got information from the PCA that we are spending approximately $39,000 in toner. So I can only guess that the use here would be relatively higher given the overall paper use. So that would add significantly to the cost of using paper. Another point of cost that you should be very aware of is that the desktop printers cost you 2 cents per print. That's compared to the biz hubs, which are about a third of that, and the high-speed printers in your duplicating centers are about a fifth of that. So it's definitely more cost-effective to use the biz hubs than the high-speed printers. The other advantage to those two other alternatives is that they can both be printed to double-sided. Right now you can't print from your computer to your desktop printer and get a double-sided print. But if you send your prints out to your biz hub, those can just come out double-sided. So it's cheaper and you can duplex. And just as a sample, we went to one of the biz hubs and printed out a record, looked at a record of 1 month of use, and we found there were 94 completed jobs. Of those 94 that were completed at the biz hub, 92 were copy jobs, and only 2 were print jobs. So what that told us is that the biz hubs are not being used primarily as printers. They're being used as copiers, which suggests that the printing is happening at the desktop printers and then being taken there for copying. And looking at the data, we found that there's a duplexing rate of about 30%, looking at that 15-month window, which is a pretty good rate. I think most of that is happening in the duplicating center, and the printing is happening down there. There are challenges to the duplexing, to raising that rate here, although I think it's a really important step to take. We've already talked about the desktop printers. Right now, one of the primary things we suggest to all the organizations we do technical assistance for is that you just set that all your printers to duplex prints that can be. The reason being that, and I'm trained originally as a psychologist, is that people do the easiest thing. They do what has the fewest barriers, and people who come from recycling know that in spades. So if you would like duplexing to improve, then you should make that the easiest thing to do at your biz hub. I'm going to turn it over now to Colleen to talk about the actions and goals that were selected by the Paper Task Force.
Good morning. Like Natalie said, my name is Colleen Hetzel, and I've been working with her. And I want to thank Representative Loeffler for all of her leadership and help on this issue and for all the staff that have helped with us with this process. they had a meeting and they came up with these goals to go forward, taking a look at how they can reduce the office paper that they're using. These are the five goals that the group came up with on their own, and the first one is to reduce the paper use that they have, and they set a very good goal of 20% overall. The second one is to take a look at that half-use paper, the one-sided paper, that has been left either by the copier printer area or has been collected by other people, and to use the non-confidential paper again in some way. They also would like to increase their duplexing rate to 50%. They actually wanted to double it to 60%. And to continue research on legal versus letter side paper and move towards using 100% recycled content paper wherever possible. By using some of these steps, reducing your paper use by 20% and also using 100% post-consumer recycled content paper, you would have some really big results. And we used the paper calculator from the Environmental Defense to calculate some of those savings just so you can have an idea of what you alone would be doing. The baseline scenario is all the way on the left, and then the middle scenario is what you guys are currently doing. So this would be just reducing, that's what you're currently doing right now with 30% recycled content paper. And then the one to the far right would be using the 100% post-consumer recycled content paper, and then also taking the 20% reduction into account. The next step, the cap to the one-sided paper, actually the reference library had some conversations with a few staff people saying that they would be interested in using that one-sided paper. And I know there are confidentiality issues and other things, but that is something that staff wanted to take a look at doing because it would be an easy step of just putting out a box and educating people that they can put one-sided paper that doesn't have any security issues or confidentiality issues out, and then the reference library would actually be interested in then taking that and using it instead of using virgin paper that they're currently using. One of the other things that could possibly, there are actually two other things that could possibly be used with that one-sided paper, and that is now downstairs in the duplicating center, the staff are doing a great job of capturing leftover letterhead from representatives that no longer work here but had extra paper left over when they were done, and they take that and they make that into tablets for use for people. And another possibility is to take that one-sided paper and put it in a designated drawer within your biz hub. That would be it. You would educate people on letting them know that that would only print out for one-sided use paper. The next step was doubling the duplex rate, and there were a few suggestions on how to do that. Set all biz hubs to default to duplex, and then have education classes for new staff and even ongoing just as things come up and things change as new printers and copiers are purchased to make sure that staff continually is educated on how to use those. Right now, as Madeline said, there are some complex issues with the biz hubs that you have. There are two sets. There's an older set and a newer set, and they do have different duplexing capabilities, and they are slightly different from one another. So that's confusing. As well as, right now, they're set at a really quick, easy, very useful pre-program approach to duplex to default. But again, it is the task of doing that one extra button as opposed to just walking up and copying. And just that one extra step makes it harder for people to duplex. But we really think that with education that these things can be overcome. Here are just some bulleted outcomes from doubling your duplex rate. And as you can see, it would be very good for the environment. Another suggestion from the group was to study legal versus letter-sized paper for bills. And right now, the Chief Sergeant at Arms did a little bit of research and said that Minnesota is one of only six states currently still using legal-sized paper instead of letter-sized. And this could potentially, in the future, lead to, if you switch to letter-sized versus legal, reduce your printer cost because you have some very large machines because of the legal size paper that you need to use. And it duplexes differently than some of the smaller printers can that use letter size. So it could potentially save you cost in the future. Yes. And then finally, and again, the group was really energetic and great. They decided to do some experimentation on using 100% recycled content paper. The Duplication Center agreed to do some test runs to see how 100% recycled content paper would work on the large machines downstairs. And other people were going to be taking a look at if it would be able to store 100% post-consumer recycled content paper on the floor to make it easy to refill the biz hubs and also the desktop printers with 100% recycled content paper. And just so you know, right now, currently on state contract, recycled content paper, 100% recycled content paper is the cheapest paper to buy. And that, we just checked this morning, and that price is going to be good for the rest of the year. So there's potential cost savings there as well. Some additional action items that we were asked to take a look at were to increase the recycling capture rate on the house floor. And again, the group was very good at this. They decided to take it upon themselves to look at different containers that could be used under each representative's desk to make it easier for them to recycle paper. And they were also going to take a look at adding additional containers for aluminum, plastic, and glass containers, beverage containers. Also, we thought it would be a good idea to establish some type of purchasing guidelines when purchasing new equipment. As old equipment dies, try to get new equipment that's going to easily duplex and meet the needs of the group. And then also adding recycling of technotrap, which is collections of CDs, discs, cords, dual cases, laptops. It can take a lot of different small technical recyclable materials, cell phones, rechargeable batteries, and Tyvek envelopes, so we can give you guys more information about that we recycle currently at the Pollution Control Agency. Mm-hmm. And then finally, taking a look at the next step. The group really wants to make specific goals so that you can measure and track to see how you're progressing. And then as a group, you'd want to confirm the adoption of those goals and make sure everybody's on board. Probably the biggest step is to delegate authority and put somebody in charge of those things so that people, when they're confused, have somebody to go to, but also make sure that that person has time to work on some of these issues, because some of them can take a little bit of time. Plan needed series of steps for each of the actions, and the group's already started, has a really good start on that. And then educate people to change the behavior and the culture of the group and determine measures, which is very important, because otherwise you won't know how well you have been doing, and you should congratulate yourself when you've taken such great steps. And that concludes our presentation for
you. Well, thank you very much. This was very interesting. 41 pounds per person.
And that was per month.
There's some really sobering things in your report, which was the point of having you go through and do an assessment so that we actually had some clue of kind of what was going on. You need that baseline data. So I thank you very much. Our whole group, thank you very much for the time that you spent on that, and certainly the staff that worked with you. I know that it's not an easy task, and so we certainly appreciate all the work that so many people have put into this effort. Representative Loeffler has some comments, I think.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just really want to echo again, and many of the staff who are involved, are here in the audience. We've had every single department of the House represented on the task force, and some of the changes that are there have already been made. Mm-hmm. Where they have got automatic duplexing in the biz hub. We are introducing people more to how you can otherwise request it when you request a print order, and trying to make people more aware of the other things. There's, for some of people on the House floor, you may have noticed that just this week we started getting some of the different recycling containers distributed to start to test out if they're going to work better in terms of not tripping our pages as they're distributing things, but also encourage people to not mix recyclables with other things, which has sometimes been an issue. So we're in ongoing discussions with the Senate and trying to see if we can partner and learn from each other, because they're ahead of us on some things and we're leading on others. So, but this has really been, I think our staff deserve most of the credit for the creativity with Madeline and Colleen giving them good ideas about avenues to pursue.
Thank you. Are there other questions or comments? Well, it's just, you know, I know that the motivation behind this was certainly that as we're talking about, you know, energy use, recycling, just looking at how we do things statewide, it was really important that the state office building, and I think that, you know, our state government, all of us, set a good example, and we also wanted to capture some of that data to show, as Representative Loeffler mentioned, you know, when we have made some changes, we'd like to quantify those, and we'd like to make sure that people know about that, because some very good things have been done, more good things are yet to come, and I think it's very important to hear that slide of the, you know, 29 steps to the rotunda is a sobering statistic. So it would be great in a few years, or hopefully not even that long, to be able to say, well, we're down to, you know, 15 or whatever would be a reasonable goal. But at any rate, I very much appreciate all of the efforts that you've gone to. And certainly it seems that, as we've heard even with discussion of other bills today, and we know that one of the main components is going to be education. First we have to identify, you know, what the problem is, then what can we do about it, and then make sure that everyone that uses this building understands. Because certainly, as we have all noted time and time again, there's a lot of discrepancy throughout the whole area. And we have a lot of different people coming into this building using it. It's a little bit different than a regular office where you have the same people, the same place all the time, and you can kind of set up the rules and say, you know, no paycheck unless you recycle. No. That's not how you do that. Anyway, but we do have, you know, a different population that we need to deal with. And so, as others have also mentioned, it's just a paramount importance to make things as convenient as possible for people. They need to understand what they have to do and then make it as easy as we possibly can. Still saying, you know, you can have a little personal responsibility here. You can kind of think about where you're going to drop that top can. But I know we have other things to talk about as well, and if I would like to see if Mike Denevis is here right now to give us. I think he's here. There he is. I couldn't see him. I was afraid he was here somewhere. Yeah. The other part of our audits and looking into how we deal with recycling is also our energy use. And so we did ask RETAP, Retired Engineer Technical Assistance Program, to come in and provide some audits regarding our energy use. And they have also worked very closely with staff, and we'll have at least a preliminary report at this point for us. So thank you, Mr. Benedict.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I understand time is very short. So I will try to do a Reader's Digest version and still give you the essence of the content here. And I'm going to be flying much higher than Madeline and Colleen. I'm going to give you kind of the overview of what we've done. I want to give you a little bit of a background on RETAP, so you know what RETAP is as well. And I brought some brochures and some cards if members want to take them for themselves, take them for their constituents. We would appreciate spreading the word is what we would appreciate. And then I talk a little bit about the RETAP process and then about some of our findings at the assessment we did at the state office building. First, with respect to RETAP, we are a group of about 16 retired engineers and scientists. We started in 2001. We were all direct contractors to the state of Minnesota, funded by a grant from a friend at the Pollution Control Agency. And our mission is to do free assessments for small to medium-sized commercial and institutional entities in the state. Our target markets are hospitality, healthcare, and education. And our primary goal is to identify problems and try to drill into that problem as much as we can without actually getting into the design phase. So the numbers we try to give our clients are numbers that we hope they can make business decisions with. At the same time, they're not design-level calculations. We think we've been pretty successful in the past. For 2004 to 2006, we had a benefit-to-cost ratio of 6 to 1. That is, for each dollar spent on us, there was $6 saved in the state on our, by our clients. So we think we're doing pretty good. It's hard for us to capture that data. We are going to continue to do that. We have a huge backlog for 2008. We will easily meet our activity standards, meaning we've got 25 assessments that we are supposed to do. We have 28 in the backlog right now, so we're kind of cooking on 2008. We're also very sensitive to the concept of performance-based metrics as well, and that's where we're trying to measure KWH and actual dollars that we save our clients. We've also added one more track this year. I'll mention very briefly the Climate Change Corps, and that's a group of about 9 retirees that will work primarily with local units of government to help them with their greenhouse gas emissions. And they've been working with cities this year. They're just getting started in 2008. We just added them in 2007, and they're working with cities and at least one county at this point. Now I want to talk a little bit about the recap process. As I said, we did a waste reduction and energy efficiency assessment of the state office building back in December. We did an on-site visit, and with the assistance of, as Madeline and Colleen mentioned, many, many staff, both from the Department of Administration and from the House. In fact, 3 of the key staff are sitting in the back of the room right now, Mike and Steve and Paul, all were integral to our services here, and we greatly appreciate their help. Without them, we couldn't have done what we've done. So we did the on-site portion, which consisted of interviews and inspections, and we've got a report in draft form right now. We hope to finish it soon. We've got a few components that we have to put together yet to finalize it, and we'll get that out then to Sergeant at Arms at the House, and then to plant management in the Department of Administration. And of course, anybody, any member who is would like a copy of the report can certainly have a copy of the report as well. And that should come out in the very near future. What we do then is we'll work with our clients to we will meet with those clients, with the House staff and with the Department of Administration staff, to drill in much deeper than I will here today into the issues and walk through our findings with them to be sure they understand it, and maybe talk about some possible solutions as well. Then we will also follow up with them. Now, to the point, some findings from the State Office Building Assessment. I'm going to start out with compliments for some good work, and I think Madeline and Colleen mentioned that, and you, Madam Chair, mentioned that there are some good things happening as well. And we found some pretty impressive things happening, in fact. From a waste generation standpoint, in 1989, the State Office Building was generating 174 tons of general trash. In 2007, 114 tons, so a reduction over that 8-year period of about 60 tons. At the same time, the recycling rate of that overall trash in 1989 was 27%, in 2007, 69%. So less is being generated, and while less is being generated, more is being recycled. From an energy use standpoint now, the building itself is 27% below in overall energy use compared to its benchmark, which is a similar building. So doing pretty good. We attribute that to the Department of Administration building automation system. They track what's going on in the building really well, and that leads me to the energy efficiency also, which is a low cost. They track something that's called a power factor, which is in essence the efficiency of energy use in the building. Keep it above 90%, you get lower rates from Excel. They've done very nicely on that. They do a very nice job of tracking that. And then lastly, water use. We calculated that, and the usage in the building is tricky to get at, but we calculated that the building uses about 20 gallons per day per occupant on average. A statistic, a comparable benchmark for a similar building is 50 to 70, so considerably less water use based on our calculations. And from an energy standpoint, now I want to get to the big message, I guess. And what we found is that 73% of the energy used in the building is electrical. And of that 72%, 76% is used for lighting, appliances, and HVAC. So the moral of the story is concentrate on electrical, concentrate on lighting and appliances, which would include motors and compressors, and HVAC. The other big message we send is, whenever possible, put in automatic control from an energy standpoint. I think Madeline and Colleen mentioned that behavior changes are difficult. If you take the human being out of the decision, that the system will work, it will change. So that's one of our overall recommendations. And then also from a overall big picture message, from a waste generation and recycling and energy standpoint, we think you just need to promote the conservation ethics within the building by creating green teams, perhaps developing sustainability policy, maybe developing a training manual, conducting some training on how folks need to do things from a recycling standpoint, from a paper generation standpoint, from an energy utilization standpoint. Because as was said earlier, there's really two possible changes that we see oftentimes, and one of which is building operation change, which is usually quote-unquote easy, but very expensive oftentimes. The other is an occupant behavior change, which is usually pretty difficult, but usually pretty inexpensive from a dollar standpoint anyway. Now I'm going to go through really quickly here some selected portions of our findings, including the categories of energy management practices, lighting, HVA systems, and waste generation and recycling practices. And I'll start out with energy management practices. And I want to elaborate a little bit on my previous point of establishing energy conservation ethic, in that we need in this building get a handle on the use of electric appliances, which would include air purifiers, coffee makers, space heaters, microwave ovens. They can be energy hogs. 600 to 800 watts for some of those appliances, which is a lot. Now, they're not on a lot, but they can drain a lot of power. The number of individual laser printers was mentioned earlier, individual printers. We have the number of 250 of those in our book. And in our report, we actually do some calculations regarding those statistics and what you can save by sending the printing to the central office area, to the central printing area. And things like computer management. Computers don't use a lot of energy, 150 watts, but when you turn them off, they're not using any. And just those management practices, those behavioral practices like that, turn the computer off, make sure it rests, et cetera, et cetera. Along the lines of appliances, just one thing I'd like to thank our folks at the PCA also for allowing us to install a couple of what are called vending misers on the two vending machines in the basement of the state office building. We've only got one in so far. We're working with Services for the Blind on getting the other one in. But the experiment we did a little pre and post experiment on that and found that it's saving about 30% energy use on that machine down there, which is pretty substantial. In our report, we'll also do some payback calculations on what that means to in terms of dollars figures and all that. To lighting, we heard some things about compact fluorescence today. We recommend wherever you've got incandescent, which is some track lighting and some desk lamps, put in compact fluorescence. They save a lot of energy. They cost more, but they save a lot of energy. We also found that the sconces in the hallways, and I'm going to estimate there are 50 per floor, I think that's conservative. Each of those has three CFLs in them. We recommend you take one of the CFLs out, take one of the ballasts out. So you've got two CFLs, one ballast. You're going to save a bunch of energy. I think I estimate, I did some rough calculations this morning as I kind of got a better count of them. I'm going to say about $1,500 a year in energy savings just from changing that out. Reducing light levels, there are some areas of the building that are fairly overlit, and I would humbly submit in the men's bathroom there's more light in there than anybody would ever need. and in some other areas as well, the hallways.
We have made it dirty.
And some of the hallways as well. And we've got some lighting readings in our report that show that the hallways may be 2 to 3 times overlit, in fact. So that's one of the reasons those CFL can come out of the sconces too. And you can save a fair amount on just going through and de-lamping in some areas, so we recommend that as well. And the behavioral concept of turning lights off, again, training people to do that, but also putting in the motion sensors, we think that's important. Now I'm going to go to HVAC, and this is a little more esoteric concept. The building, as some of you may know, receives heating and cooling water from district energy. And The efficiency of the cooling system is less than perfect, shall we say. There's a little bit of a temperature differential going on between district energy's cooling water and the cooling water in the building. We suggest that get looked at in order to make sure that that's running as efficiently as possible. Seventh floor, We recommend that the seventh floor insulation in the roof and the walls be looked at, maybe an infrared scan of that. Also, there's some short circuiting of the heating and cooling up there, such that the intake and the outlet are fairly close, so that short circuits, it doesn't get to where it needs to be, the heating doesn't, and it's just generally kind of a heating and cooling problem that should be looked into. Another thing that relates to airflow, and as you folks experience much more than I, but I think these rooms vary a lot in their comfort level and the airflow in them. We recommend that you look at something called economizers, and Department Administration gets all this. Make sure that the economizers are very efficient. The economizers, basically what they do is they make sure the incoming air is the proper amount of air and proper temperature. So you can use CO2 levels, you can use what's called an enthalpy measurement device as well to do that. So we recommend that get done. Along the lines of the chillers, the building has an existing train chiller and a couple of others. We recommend that in conjunction with looking at the efficiency of the cooling system from district energy, the train chiller should be evaluated as to whether it could be rebuilt, and then purchase an additional chiller in order to complement that, and then just cancel the district energy contract. So that needs a little bit of looking into. And I'll skip to the last couple of things really quickly here. The Z-fold towels in the bathroom, and I experienced those this morning. Recommendation is get rid of those guys, because a lot of those are going to trash. You want one, you get six. So we recommend something other than that in the bathroom. And also, we recommend you implement the paper use reduction program and the good work of the task force. I think it's incredibly important to reduce the paper. I think there's a good track record of doing that. I think that needs to be continued. Last thing I'm going to mention is recycling of CDs and DVDs. That doesn't seem to be getting done here. Most other things are at least in theory able to be captured. Maybe we need a little bit more training in order to capture them more efficiently, but that's about it. With that, I'm going to end, and if there are questions, I would be happy to deal with them if we have time.
Thank you very much for that report, and I'm afraid we won't have much time for questions today, since maybe if we have one very quick one, but we need to vacate the room, and there's another occupancy coming in here. Is there a quick question?
No. What do we do? Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, I think the next thing that we need to do is, I had some conversations with some other folks from the admin department the other day as well, and I think I'll be looking forward to your complete report, and also the next thing we need to do is, you know, make sure that we designate someone, whether it's on the task force that Representative Lassler has been working so hard with, to come out with these recommendations to make sure that we tell people, you know, what's been going on and how we make those behavior changes that have been suggested here today. If people don't know what to do with things, they're not going to do it. So we certainly need to go there. We're not through with this project yet, but this is sort of a midpoint report, if you will, and hopefully it's closer to the end than to the midpoint. We had hoped to have this in place before session started, but at any rate, we will move ahead as quickly as possible. I think all of you that worked on this, I know there were many, many people, staff, again, worked very hard with the folks that came in to audit, and we know that many changes have already been in place to augment the good things that have been going on currently, and we want to make sure that people know about those as well. So we will hear more from everyone at a future meeting. And
can I just apologize on behalf of the committee to the people who came here to talk about beverage containers today, that we just timed out and didn't get to that.
Right. I extend my apologies as well. I hope you found the rest of the proceedings extremely interesting and well worth your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.